The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Brené Brown. Dr. Brown is a research professor at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work, where she has studied vulnerability, courage, worthiness, and shame. She is the best-selling author of The Gifts of Imperfection, Daring Greatly, and Rising Strong, which has just been released in paperback. She is also the founder and CEO of The Daring Way and Courage Works, an online learning community for individuals and organizations. Her 2010 TEDx Houston talk, The Power of Vulnerability, is one of the top five most viewed TED Talks in the world. Brené, welcome to the show.
I'm excited to be with you. Thank you for having me, Kelly.
In reading both Daring Greatly and Rising Strong recently, I was struck by a theme that's found its way through many of our conversations on this podcast. And I looked up a paper that was written by one of our very first guests on the show. And this guy is the Reverend Dr. Samuel Wells. He is the vicar of St. Martin in the Fields. And I found him because he wrote a book on improvisation and ethics like 10 years ago. And he wrote, quote, "If the fundamental human problem is isolation, then the solutions we are looking for do not lie in the laboratory or the hospital or the frontiers of human knowledge or experience. Instead, the solutions lie in things we already have, most of all in one another." And that struck me that that's what you're talking about in terms of connection.
Oh my God, that's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, I think that we are hardwired, I mean, neurobiologically hardwired to be in connection with each other. And in the absence of connection, in the absence of being seen in our lives by someone else, being seen and valued, there is always, without exception, suffering. There is hurt, there is addiction, there's brokenness, there's physical illness. You know, in the absence of connection, there's suffering. And so I do think, I mean, I think that is probably the heart of my work. I do think without connection, we're lost, and the only path to find each other is really vulnerability, to really let ourselves be seen, to take the armor off, and we're not great at it.
No. And isn't it interesting, that word connection, which I think in this day and age is a digital word, that's what most people go to.
Yeah.
When indeed that's standing in between individuals in many ways. I understand the sort of greater connection. I love having my Facebook feed to see what my, you know, grade school friends are, but it's in the way.
Yeah, and I think we've confused communication with connection. Mm. So I think these are great communication tools, but they're only actually connection tools if we're making plans to be together on social media. So if we're using social media as a way to gather with real intent to connect, that's one thing. But if we're checking feeds and we are, you know, lurking around, then that's just a communication tool. And, you know, and I'm not saying that without communication we suffer. I'm saying without deep connection. I mean, communication should be in the service of connection, not a replacement for.
Yeah, and I have a 14-year-old daughter. So, and you know this, because I said the sentence started in your book. Recently, my daughter and I were having this conversation about someone acting out on social media, which is, you know, I said that yesterday to her.
Yeah.
You know, literally, and she, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, that she has friends who will not, they'll only argue via text. And when she sort of says, "I want to have this hash out, let's FaceTime or let's do it in person," they won't do it. And that feels...
No, that's absolutely right.
It's the worst. That's the worst.
You know, it's fear, and it's fear driven by I've been a college professor for a little over 20 years, and so I've really watched. I mean, not only have I been a college professor, but I've been a qualitative researcher, you know, sitting across from people. I've really watched how we've changed. And I think one of the refusals to do this in person is fear. It's too vulnerable. It's too uncomfortable. You know, I think kids would say it's awkward. Mm-hmm. But what we don't realize is that vulnerable, awkward, uncomfortable, that's the magic.
Yeah.
Like that's the foundation for real connection.
And it's interesting, too, because and I want to talk about story, because that fits with what you're talking about. So I think many of us are drawn to your work because you're such a ridiculously good storyteller. And I've worked a lifetime in the theater. So stories are both my trade and my passion. And you write in the beginning of Rising Strong, quote, "When we own our stories, we avoid being trapped as characters in stories that someone else is telling." And I think that is a condition that I think exists maybe for the majority of humanity, is that they're in someone else's story.
They are. They're in someone else's story. They're in someone else's plot line. And I think what the faulty thinking is, you know what? I'd rather stay here and let someone else narrate my life than take that first step of taking back authorship, which is I have to own the story. I have to say, yes, I experienced this. Yes, I went through this. Yes, I failed. Yes, we're getting a divorce. Yes, my kid's in rehab. Whatever the story is, yes, mm-hmm. you know, our team dropped the ball on this project and it cost us $1 million, you know, whatever it is. They want to, you know, the minute you deny a story, that sucker owns you. And the minute you own a story, you can write the ending. But the fear, it's shame, it's perfectionism, it's paralysis about what other people will think, which is very much related to perfectionism. And so I think we want to be the authors of our own lives. But that first step of stepping up to it and owning it is just debilitating for people, myself included at times.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and look, it's not, you know, we fail so constantly, you know, and we have so many sort of structures to try to put up, and we're going to fail anyway. And I often tell people, too, like, think about the best story someone told you. It's never when everything worked out. The best stories anyone tells you are fiascos. And when we can own that particular story, that's a very powerful thing. And I think that's where your work on vulnerability shows, the ability to sort of own our mistakes and our failures and somewhat like really get in there with them, you know, sort of play with them. And every great comedic actor I've worked with is just awash in their own ability to relate their failings. It's actually a very empowering thing for them as performers to do that up on stage in front of so many people.
No, you know, I think that's right. I have so many questions for you. I don't know how that's
go ahead. You can ask questions. That is allowed. That's absolutely allowed.
No, so like one of the things I was going to say about owning the story is that's a huge, I mean, I don't know if you've been told this, and I don't know if this is how I landed here, luckily, but I'm a huge fan of Yes And. Yeah, and I mean, it's not just material for me. It mm-hmm. is absolutely how I live, how we parent, and how we work. I mean, it happened this morning. Like this morning in the office, there was a big yes and moment. And to me, that's at the heart. This is the piece that people miss about owning your story. So I have a really, we just, like we experienced this recently, you know, we have very high tolerance for risk. And my thing is, as a leader, you know, let's take smart chances. Let's make smart risks. You know, do our due diligence, but let's go out there. And the only thing I ask is that if it's a screw up, I ask that we learn from it as fast as we can, embed what we've learned in the culture, and move forward.
Right.
That's it. And so the thing is that people don't understand that you can say, we screwed up, yes, and here's what we learned from it.
Right.
Here's what we will do differently that we would have never known before. That yes and, yes, I'm getting a divorce. yes, it's shocking to all of our friends because we've been together for 15 years or whatever it is. And this is also happening in my life right now. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's that ability. Yes, and is the payoff of owning the story, because if you get to say, and I'm not done yet, you've caught me mid-chapter, I'll let you know when the chapter's over and how it ends.
Right.
And that's the powerful piece.
Yeah. I talk to a lot of business groups, because obviously that's something that Second City has done, and the Yes And,
yeah.
The Yes And book was essentially a business book. And what I always have to tell them is, like, this is not Pollyannic by any stretch. And it doesn't mean you're not going to get to a no. In fact, Yes And creates the kind of abundance that allows no to be quite easy and not weigh so much on your shoulders, because you've really vetted the sort of all the different possibilities, and you've been thoughtful and you've been active and all those moments. And so it's an orientation, and it's become a bit of a bumper sticker. I know that. But you know, what I've just seen, because I've worked at Second City for 30 years, right? And we create shows out of nothing. Six people on a stage, they don't have anything, and they take 12 weeks. It would not happen if you don't have Yes And. And it has a way of forming really, really strong bonds with people.
You know, yeah, it's not Pollyanna. And it's, you know, I always think they should call this stuff the hard skills, not the soft skills.
Exactly.
I'd much rather learn, like, PowerPoint and Excel than do this work.
Yeah.
Because this shit is so hard.
Mm-hmm.
I just cussed on your podcast.
It's okay. No. I cuss all the time, and it's fine.
Okay, great. Because, you know, I think, you know, there's this great quote by Einstein that said, if I had an hour to solve a problem, I'd spend 50 minutes defining the problem and 10 minutes answering it. And to me, the Yes And is a very sophisticated problem identification process. You know, and so I'll give you an example of today how we used it.
Yeah.
I just remembered how it came out. We were in a meeting. So I get about, I don't know, 2,000 speaking requests a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I take about 6% of them. And because I have university commitments and I have kids, and it
right.
just, I take very few. And so I kept thinking, there's got to be a way for us not to say no, you know, 1,900 times
mm.
or 1,950 times. You're like, no, you have to set boundaries. You have to say no, you know. And then I thought, you know, but there's a lot of other ways we can reach people with our work. There are a lot of other assets and things that we can share with them that may make their meeting better, their life better. And so I'm like, let's just do a yes and, okay. Brene's work would be a great fit with what you're going through right now in your organization. And she won't be able to come there. And we do have, you know, like, what is the and? And people were like sweating, literally.
Yeah.
Because we, everywhere in our lives, we have equated boundaries with no.
Mm-hmm.
Personal boundaries, professional boundaries with no. And I'm a big believer in boundaries. I think, you know, one of the most shocking revelations I've had from my own research was trying to figure out what the most compassionate people I've researched over 15 years, you know, 200,000 pieces of data, what did the most compassionate people have in common?
Mm-hmm.
The answer was boundaries.
Hmm.
They were also the most boundaried.
Which,
and so we thought, you know, boundaries equals no.
Mm-hmm.
But when you dig into it, it really, boundaries is really yes and. Well, you know, you keep getting drunk at these Christmas parties that I have every year. I really want you to be there with your family, but how much you're drinking is making me uncomfortable. It's making other guests uncomfortable, and I don't like it in front of my kids. So I'd love for you to come, but I'm going to ask that you don't drink.
It's hard.
So are you saying I get too wasted at your party? Yes. And I'm also saying I'd love for you to be there, but I have to ask you not to do that next time.
That's so hard. That's so hard.
Right, that's like big girl panty time.
No, exactly, and I don't know if you know Scott Barry Kaufman's work, the cognitive psychologist.
I do.
All right, so he's a friend, and you know he wrote that terrific book on gifted, because you know Scott was identified with a learning disability, and couldn't be smarter, right? And is a lovely human being, and you know he talks about this idea around for the creative mind, the way we're wired to create, that you need a high tolerance for disorder and disarray, the ability to extract order from chaos, and most of all, the willingness to take risks. And what a risk that is to tell the truth to a friend. But there's not a greater act of friendship than doing something like that.
No, because the alternative is that I invite you, I talk bad about you every day leading up to the party. I talk bad at you about you after the party. Yeah. I'm not having a good time because I'm on eggshells about your drinking. Like, it's just the whole thing is a shit show unless you show up and say, you know, I call it in my work big, what boundaries need to be in place for me to be in my integrity and be generous towards you. Mm-hmm. And that's very much, yes, I am asking that you not drink. Well, maybe I'll just have a couple glasses. I want you to come, but I'm asking that you don't drink. A couple glasses is not going to work.
Yep. Wow.
It's hard.
It's really hard. And I think one of the reasons it's hard is this idea of scarcity. And I want to talk to you about that because it's devastatingly important. And I've just been reading Sendhil Melanathan's and Elder Shafir's book, Scarcity. And they note, quote, while scarcity plays a starring role in many important problems, abundance sets the stage for it. And you write, scarcity thrives in a culture where everyone is hyper aware of lack. And I think that's saying the same thing, you know, in two different ways. That culture, right? Culturally,
totally.
we're screwing ourselves because we're sort of, you know, cognitively making, you know, scarcity happen, and it doesn't need to.
No, read that quote to me again. I want to wrap my head around that last piece about abundance.
Yeah, this is the one from the book, Sendhil's.
Yeah.
It is, while scarcity plays a starring role in many important problems, abundance sets the stage for it.
So one of the things I write about in Daring Greatly is I do not believe that the opposite of scarcity is abundance. I think the opposite of scarcity is enough.
Yep.
And if you're going to feel scarcity every time you don't feel abundant love, abundant promotions, abundant happiness, abundant money, you're just screwed. Mm-hmm. Because that doesn't exist. And that is part of some kind of movement that I think this is an unintentional consequence. Mm-hmm. But enough is enough.
Yeah.
Like, we don't even have, like, we don't, enough is not the right word. Like, there's one language that I found in the world, and it's Swedish, of course. Swedes are always, like, out front on, the Swedes and the Germans are always out front on good words and, like.
And the Finnish. I think the Finnish. That's the threesome. Yeah.
Yeah. But they have a word, like, it's like lagum or some, I'm sure your Swedish listeners are like, geez, she never heard of it. But, like, it means, like, enough. It's like after you have dinner. And you don't have to, like, undo your jeans, but you're also not still hungry and picking at stuff on the counter. You're just like, it's enough. And so, to me, the big hallmark of scarcity, I can always, like, if I go into work with an organization or work with leaders and I do an assessment of the organization, like, two of the things that are the biggest indicators of scarcity is if, in a culture, it's the same in the U.S. right now, if the conversation revolves around, what am I supposed to be terrified about today, and whose fault is it?
Right.
Those are the hallmarks of scarcity.
Yeah.
And so we just never say, you know, it's enough. I'm enough. What I'm contributing is enough. And it's not complacency. People always say, like, well, I want to strive for excellence. No one strives for excellence out of a place of scarcity.
Right, right. And these authors, too, were finding the connection, the same thing that drives a poor person to do payday loans was the same thing that drove a very wealthy stockbroker to make a terrible trade. You know, that there's neurological connections between, you know, what scarcity can be, that this is not just a problem for poor people or not just a problem for an executive. It's a human problem.
It's a human problem. And it's, you know, like, if you look at our culture today, here's what I'll tell you. Put, you know, I started my research about 6 months before 9/11. And I've watched fear change us over the last dozen years. And you keep people in enough scarcity, and you can, that is stuff you can definitely manufacture. Mm-hmm. You keep people in enough scarcity and enough fear, and you give them someone to blame and give them a false sense of certainty about what you can do, you can get away with anything. You could lead people off a cliff. As long as you give them some sense of scarcity, I mean, some sense of certainty, even though if it's counterfeit, mm-hmm. if people are so desperate for certainty when they feel scarcity, and then give them someone to blame or hate, you can do anything you want.
Is that also connected to storytelling in the sense that we need, I mean, you talk about us being wired for story. And so, you know, we can make those stories catastrophic. And in some ways we go to that.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, I mean, I think, you know, when we say we're wired for story, like, that was a great saying a decade ago. Today it's like neurobiological truth. Like, we know that the brain is really wired. I mean, that's why, you know, long before researchers and long after researchers, your people and your tribe will be running the world, because as long as there's been story and laughter and shared collective emotion, that's always been a part of our history. And so when something difficult happens, our brain literally craves a story, and it's wired to recognize the narrative pattern of beginning, middle, and end. And the brain, you know, the brain's wired for one thing above all else. It's not, there's not even a close second. Like, you know, I mean, there's just not even a close second. Mm-hmm. And so when something difficult happens, and that's not just like if a bear is attacking us, but if we're in a difficult conversation about drinking at a party,
right.
Our brain says, give me a story to tell me what's going on so I can protect you. It does not want a story that's complex with a lot of variables and a lot of dependencies. It wants a story of bad guy, good guy, dangerous, safe, our friend, our enemy. That's it. Hmm. And when we give the brain a story, and the clearer the story is, and the less nuanced it is, the more chemical reward we get from the brain. And so if you say something funny to me on the phone, I get off the phone, I'm like, damn, I think Kelly's really pissed off about something I said during that interview, and I don't think he ever liked me. And, you know, all of a sudden my brain's like, oh, chemical reward. We were feeling uncertain, and now you solved it for us. Kelly doesn't like you, and we need, you know. The problem is the brain rewards us chemically for a story, mm-hmm. regardless of its accuracy. And so we go to those catastrophic, dress-rehearsed tragedy stories because it's a way we protect ourselves. So they become very dangerous because they derive our behavior. So now I get off the phone with you, I call our friend Scott and say, look, I did this great interview with Kelly, and he's actually super pissed off at me, and I don't know what I did. And then, you know, and then all of a sudden, everyone's behavior has changed. No one's in their integrity and their ethics, all because of just some very lizard brain wiring that says, keep me safe.
Right. And you don't meditate, right?
I try.
I mean, I'm not good at it.
I'm not great at it, but okay. I do try.
So my wife meditates, and she's the one who introduced me to your work. She has also been a teacher of improvisation for 30 years. And we had I got to talk to Charles Lim, who is a scientist who is at Johns Hopkins. And he does sort of cochlear implants, if I'm saying
correctly. Yeah.
And his study, because he's a jazz musician. So he literally, he created a plastic piano so he could put it in an MRI machine to, you know, study the human brain when it improvised. And the major finding that he found is that part of the brain that self-censors reduces like crazy when you're improvising, which is the fear part of the brain.
Oh my God, I love this.
Oh, it was unbelievable. And he's still studying this, and you know, the other fascinating thing he told me, I just think you find this interesting, is as much as they've done incredible work with these implants, the cochlear implants, the one thing that you can't hear when you get those implants is music.
Really?
Yeah. So you could maybe hear a beat, but you can't distinguish between a violin and a clarinet. And this made me profoundly sad.
Yeah.
And he contends that if he can get it so that they can hear music, he'll solve any hearing problem. And I guess I guess I'm telling you this because there's a bit of a metaphor probably inside a bit. But what I found with my inability to meditate and find that, but when I am improvising, there is amount. We have this phrase of play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. There is rules and nudges. Yeah, all this stuff that I have to fall back on to keep me there. And it's messy and it's verbal. And it's dirty a lot and all that stuff, which is what happens in comedy when you turn into comedy. But it is glorious. I mean, the feeling afterwards is, I think, similar to what someone who's been able to quiet their mind. It's like loud meditation.
I have goosebumps. Yeah, because I just believe it. I think, so when you said, do you meditate? I do centering prayer, and I do it while I do a walking meditation of centering prayer. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure my neighbors, I mean, several of them, like, will pull their children close to them as I walk by.
Yes.
Because I'm always talking out loud. I'm waving my hands.
Mm-hmm.
But it's gotten to the point where sometimes people say, I think you need to walk.
Right.
And, you know, and I'll say, but it's like 30 degrees and raining. And he's like, I still think you need to walk. So I'll bundle up and just literally get soaking wet, because when I'm walking and doing this thing, it's exactly what you're saying. It's like I'm too busy to even remember to put the armor on and protect myself. But it's when everything comes to me.
And the saying is important, right? The actual verbal act.
Oh, God, yes. No, I have to say it out loud, even when I'm by myself.
I forget who told me this, so take credit when you're listening to the podcast. But Scott, when Scott was, Barry Kaufman, our friend, was speaking in Dubai, and he actually said, I'm nervous before this big speech. Does anyone have advice for me? And I forgot someone who told me this, and it works for me because I do a lot of public speaking, is say out loud, don't say you're nervous, say I'm excited. And I've done that before, like, I'm excited. I'm like, no, and my wife and I do this for each other. And Scott did it, and he goes, you know, I think that kind of worked. And I don't know the science behind that, but the saying of it seems important.
Yeah, I believe that for sure, because one of the things I have to do before I speak is I always say the same little prayer about strength and courage and be open and don't, you know. My prayer is very much play the scene, not the one you want to be in.
Yeah.
And I have to say it out loud. So, you know, I'm sure there are 80 people all over the world that think I'm nuts, but there is something about saying, like, you know, like, be brave, I'm excited. You know, it's, yeah, there's something to all this. And at one point, that's why I'm like, the researchers will catch up, but the truth tellers, the storytellers, the people that make us laugh. Oh, and can I ask my question now?
Yes, please.
Yeah, but those people will always be ahead, because mm-hmm. that they started with humans and they'll end with humans.
Yep.
Here's my question. So, because of this idea that people think, you know, I'm a researcher and a storyteller, mm-hmm. they ask me a lot about storytelling. And one of the things I'm seeing a lot of that I want your thought about, I need a way to articulate this, is I never tell a story on a stage as part of my work that I haven't in some way resolved. Like, if I'm in the middle, like, I'll show you the scar and we'll talk about it and probably laugh about part of it, but I'm not going to show you a gaping wound. I'm not going to bring you into something I haven't resolved yet, because when I'm in the receiving end of that, it doesn't feel good. What do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. It's making me think of something. So about, I don't know, like 6 years ago, it was nonstop loss at Second City. All the founders of the theater passed away within like a 4-year period. Mary Scruggs, who is one of our, like, she's like my age, I'm 50, my wife's best friend, she passed away unexpectedly. And like, we kept getting hits, right? And our parents are getting older, and that's going on.
Yeah.
And there was also dysfunction at the theater in terms of, you know, some management shit. And the cast that was on stage was exceptionally gifted. And they were going through their own stuff. And what happened was one of the actors, his wife had a miscarriage. And this is during the process. And mm-hmm. and when you're in theater, you know, you don't not show up. So this is, I mean, yeah. So he was coming and he's writing the show. And I came to see a preview and the director's like, hold on to your hat. I had to let this actor put the scene in, which was tying together some of the themes. And in the scene that was literally in the second act of the show, he went to heaven to talk to his son who had died. And I will say this, and the producer was with me, Allison, we're holding hands, we're crying, but people who were in the audience who had no idea about the truth that was going on were crying as well. And this is at Second City. You're not going there to cry.
Yeah.
And what he said later, because it stayed in the show, it was a beautiful part of the show, huge reviews for the show. And he sort of said, he's like, this was my therapy, was working out in front of the audience, and was the only thing I could do. The scene had laughs. So I think you can, and I think it's dangerous to open up that. And this is a professional storyteller. I would say you are a professional storyteller. But you don't. Here's the thing: when you do that, it can go a lot of different ways. And the question of your particular vulnerability when you're in. Well, this is all about being in the middle, right? It's just being in the middle and utterly exposed on stage.
That's so helpful because I think there was, you know, starting last year, this real big, like, well, my TED Talk will go viral or I'll get this thing if I'm super vulnerable. And then people didn't think through the intention of them, why they were sharing something or how they were sharing it.
Right.
And I think sometimes it can not go well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what you were saying is, what's your skill level? What's your experience? And are you prepared? You know, one of the things I try to tell people is if the audience response dictates whether you heal from something or not, it's probably not a good idea to share it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Because I've seen that happen. I mean, there's, I don't know if you, do you know the stand-up Tig Notaro?
Oh, God, yes, I love her.
Exactly. And that act, and she went, for those who don't know, she went on stage and announced her cancer the basically hours after she got the diagnosis.
Yes.
And it became, like, everyone that night was emailing the whole community, old comedy community, is like, this incredibly brave act that was so honest. And Tig could do that because Tig was at a level of a mastery of a conversation. And here's the thing, too, about... This is the difference between drama and comedy. So my wife is a comedy professor. That's what she does. And she's at a university, at Columbia College. They have the first ever comedy major in writing performance in the country.
Really cool.
It's totally cool. And she gets in arguments because everyone's like, why isn't that part of drama? And she's like, it's completely different. If you're doing drama, you do not pay attention to the audience. The audience doesn't matter. Comedy doesn't exist without the audience. It is actually it is in between the audience. Because if you tell a joke in a room and no one's there, I can't tell me it's comedy. So it's that very unusual place that's in between. And so a performer like Tig or even just using the word performance requires a level of skill when you move it to the sort of stage professional level. I think it still exists in our human-to-human interaction. The stakes are completely different when your audience is your spouse or your kids, right?
No, for sure. 100%.
Yeah. We're literally running out of time, and I have six pages of notes, and I basically did half one page. So
it's so fun. Sorry that I.
No, I'm treasuring my moments with you, and I know I normally ask a yes and story, and I feel like you've got so many that maybe that's like we don't need to.
Yeah. Agreed.
So then there's a line in your book, and this has just stuck with me. And it's a saying from the Asara tribe, and I think they're Indonesian or Papua New Guinea. And it is, quote, knowledge is only a rumor until it lives in the muscle. Man, I just want to unpack that to sort of draw this out, because I'll say it again. Knowledge is only a rumor until it lives in the muscle. What's that mean to you?
Well, I think for me, what it means is that until you put what you've learned into practice, until I can know everything there is to know about, you know, being a better parent or being a, you know, showing up for my partner in a better way. I can know all of that, but until I actually start doing it and have to wade through all the crap that comes with it and get stuck and have those hard moments, it's just a rumor. But when you start practicing it and you start failing and climbing yourself, you know, climbing back out of it, that's when it lives in your bones. That's when you're like, I know what that means. Like, I know what it means to really lose somebody. I know what it means to really show up for a hard conversation. I know what it means to ask for help when I want to act like I have my shit together all the time. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it goes back to something I said in the Gifts of Imperfection, which is knowing ourselves. I'm all for it. It's awesome. But it has very little bearing compared to how we treat ourselves every day. The way we talk to ourselves, the way we take care of ourselves. That's the big one.
Hmm. You know, we started the podcast with that quote from Sam Wells, and I discovered him through this book about improvisation and ethics. And the thesis of that book was that the only way you could teach ethics was through improvised action, because that's the only way you're going to feel it, and that suddenly the idea of behaving ethically is a muscle.
I think that's true. I think that it's really, like, I talk to people all the time about, yes, you can learn what courage is, you can practice, but you have to embed it, and you have to be able to show up for a conversation and screw it up at least 10 times. In fact, when we teach empathy, because empathy is a real skill set, and when we teach empathy, we have people sign a big board that says, I promise to practice, screw it up, circle back, and make it right.
You make them say it.
Yeah.
Love it.
Totally. 100%.
Brené Brown, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, God. Thanks, Kelly. Thanks for all that you're doing. I love it. Well, I've been working.
Working, about to slip down, working, going, working.